For this evening's talk, I'd like to first of all start by just asking everyone to be very settled, very still, and to take this chance, you know, this chance of quietness together, so to take that chance to turn the mind inward and notice how your body and your present experience, notice how that feels for you. What is the actual experience which is vivid in the mind right now? Notice how there's this, that field of experience which the mind is aware of. Notice how it's complex, it's shifting, and it's demanding. It wants us to move, it wants us to scratch the itch, it wants us to shift things, adjust. Why is that? Why is it so hard to be still? We are animals. That means we're animated. This is the nature of our existence, is that we're driven to move. It's the difference between the living and the dead. Sometimes they call the quick and the dead. It's very curious that we go around our whole life and not notice these things, and then as soon as we sit down to meditate, suddenly the body starts to reveal itself to us. By the body here, I mean our own inner perception of our physical embodied experience. And suddenly we become hyper aware of different aches and pains, tensions, itches, all of those things that somehow live in the background of ordinary experience, but not particularly important to us, and suddenly they become so important as soon as we sit down to meditate, so demanding. According to Buddhist theory, what's happening is that the second of the three characteristics, that is the characteristic of dukkha or suffering, is starting to reveal itself. And one of the observations which the Visuddhimagga makes, which I think is quite insightful, is that suffering is concealed by shifting postures. It's something which doesn't make any sense to a non-meditator, but to a meditator is very obvious. We sit for a while in one posture, we want to shift our legs, stretch our back, adjust ourselves somehow, and just to sort of relieve the tension. Somehow that just makes things easier. Somehow our body is not built or not content just to stay where it is. It wants to move. It feels this need, this drive, this push to be constantly moving, constantly doing. So in this we can see, of course, all three of the three characteristics are at work. The characteristic of impermanence, that it's changing, our experience is changing. The pains which weren't there before suddenly become present, or pains which were present disappear. And the pains which remain change while they're still there. And so this whole field of experience which we're being given to, so which we are being given, which we are being presented with, this is in constant flux. And we also see the final of the three characteristics is present here, is the characteristic of anatta, not self. So not self manifests most obviously or simply in the fact that we can't control things. So how the Buddha argued that we think of these things as ourself, and yet we can't control it. We can't make these feelings go away, the painful feelings. We can't make the pleasant feelings remain. How can it be ourself if we can't even do a simple thing like that with it? And on a more subtle level, we understand not self as the mistake, or the illusion of a self as being the mistake that we identify with those feelings, and so we think that somehow they belong to us, that they're part of us, and so they affect us. So we can see that it's part of the nature of human psychology, that the things that are closest to us, generally speaking, tend to affect us more. So if I feel a pain, I'm very directly affected by that. If someone I'm close to feels a pain, then I also have an emotional response to that. I can't feel the physical pain, but I still feel feeling of compassion and so on. If it's somebody that I'm less close to, then the feeling is less strong. If it's somebody that I don't know at all, then very often we don't feel anything. The development of the capacity to feel an emotional response for people that we don't know at all is part of the higher development of humanity. That's not something which necessarily we automatically feel. And so this is like showing how the boundaries of the self and what we consider to be I and what's belonging to or pertaining to I get stretched, and our notion of self thins out as it gets further away from us, from this center here. So we take these feelings and these pains and pleasures and so on to belong to us, to have some kind of intrinsic or inherent relationship with who we are. And again, the Buddha, of course, critiqued this idea by saying, well, if the feeling is really who you are, or part of who you are, then what happens when the feeling goes? You still remain. You still feel just as much you as you were when the feeling was there, and so how can that feeling really be part of you? So this is using that reflection of not self. So all of these characteristics are there, and they can all be used as part of our meditative contemplation of these things. But the simplest and most direct thing in this particular case is the characteristic of dukkha, of suffering, of pain. Now, when our body is giving us signals, what's happening there? Well, obviously you've got a certain biological component to this, a stimulus on various nerve cells and so on, and signals, patterns of energy that's electrochemical energy that's sent to the brain, and then the brain goes to different parts of the brain, is interpreted and so on in different ways, and spreads out through different networks and firing different kinds of responses and so on. And we can understand that biologically that these things serve a certain usefulness, they have a certain functionality. Pain tells us when a hand is too near the fire. It tells us when we're touching sharp objects. It tells us when we've been injured by falling over. It tells us when something's biting us, or when we're developing some kind of illness. And so we've got this constant alert system which is informing us how our body's going, and guiding or suggesting appropriate responses. But sometimes it seems that what actually is happening to us through the bodies goes far beyond what's necessary. And we get a kind of a warning about something, and then it's okay, right? I've got that warning. I know my hand. I put my hand near the fire. I know it got burnt. Fine. I've taken my hand away, but do you have to keep hurting now? And so the pain keeps on hurting, even though there's no particular functionality for it left. So that kind of basic sort of biological function that pain has is only a part of the picture, a very small part actually. And I think that the level and the detail of the information which our body is feeding to us all the time has a much more important and profound role, and that is to create our sense of identity and our sense of who we are in the world. It's not just an alarm system. it's a very creation of who we are. We are that which feels these things. So one of the techniques we use in Buddhism, and especially in Buddhist meditation, is to stop and watch. And our body wants to move, we don't. Feel the urge to move your body, and just don't. And just like if you, for example, feel an itch, and just don't scratch it. You just watch it. And it's almost overwhelming need that arises. And you have to scratch it. Or if there's a feeling of restlessness in the body, feeling like you have to move, constantly being provoked to move. What for? What actually happens if you don't scratch the itch? Well, nothing. What actually happens if you don't move your body? Well, nothing. It doesn't actually do anything. And yet this need arises, this drive. So one of the skills that we have to learn in meditation is the skill to not bow to the demands of this kind of restlessness and this kind of seeking and escape. Just to stay still. And we're like a rock in the middle of a river. And the river's flowing swiftly down, and in the middle of it is just a rock remaining steady. It's not worried by the fact that the river's pulling at it all the time, it just stays there. Now when we do this and we feel ourselves being pulled around all the time by the feelings and the pain and so on, initially it feels like we're having to force ourselves against it. So we're having to create an equal and opposite counterforce in order to be able to stay still. And that of course is not very sustainable, because every time we have one force in the mind going one way, we have to generate another force in the mind going the other way. So we're actually doubling the amount of forces and energies that's moving in the mind. So that kind of approach, the very kind of effortful and deliberate approach, forcing the mind this way and that, it can be useful sometimes. You know, we need a little bit of it, especially in the beginning, to overcome the initial resistance and get a bit of stability. But it's not really going to do us a whole lot of good in the long term. And thankfully there's something else involved. Our mind isn't so simple as all that. Our mind is not just wanting to push and pull and move and shake and shift all the time. There's also a part of us, part of the human mind, which wants to be still. That's how it seems to me anyway. It seems to me that there's something in our nature as humans that loves peace. That part of us is not necessarily present all the time. It's not It's not the dominant force a lot of the time, because obviously we're seeking entertainment and distraction a lot of the time as well. But there's something about that, isn't there? There's something about us that loves the quietness of the dawn, or the stillness of the forest. There's something about us that loves to look at the ocean. And there's something about us that responds and resonates to the idea of peace. And peace itself is a peculiar notion, because like a lot of the words we use in Buddhism, peace and liberation and emptiness and so on, it doesn't actually denote anything. I mean, peace isn't anything, is it? Peace is just the absence of conflict. Peace doesn't have any quality by itself, but is filled with whatever is there, whatever's happening. When a nation like Australia is at peace, and hopefully that might happen sometime within our lifetimes, we're not actually at war, then it doesn't mean that the nation stops existing. It doesn't mean that we're not doing anything. We go about our lives and do everything, but it just means we don't do that in that conflictive manner. So peace itself doesn't have any, it's something we love, we have a feeling for, an affinity for, a yearning for, and yet it's not a thing, it doesn't exist. We can't define it and pin it down so easily. And I think that there's something very profound in this. There's something very profound in the human longing for peace. And if we want to be able to find peace in our meditation, then rather than battling with the restlessness, taking it head on, I think it's more useful to connect with that inner longing or need for peace. We can feel. And again, as we're sitting here, when we started this talk, I asked you to just connect with the experience, with the feelings and the different tensions and energies moving in your body. Now I'd like to ask you to just connect with the sensation of peace. Something inside you that resonates with this idea. And when we just hear these words, peace, silence, emptiness, calm. Can we feel how we settle back into that? Our focus is on that peace. And that becomes the center of our awareness, the thing that's most important for us. And when that's our focus, then those other things that are happening, the pains, the itches, the restlessness, the tensions, the energy moving, they're not so important to us anymore. Remember that our mind tends to focus and give importance to those things which we're paying attention to. They're the things we get concerned about, get worried about. So we can see these two different orientations that we can use. And these correspond to different approaches in meditation. Some kinds of meditations, if you learn them, for example, Goenka technique, and then that of course teach you to be scanning your body and being aware of the physical feelings in the body, so you're very much in that kind of movement mode. Other kinds of meditation, more samatha-based meditations, encouraging you to develop that stillness and that center of quietness. In both cases, you're being mindful, you're being aware, you're developing your wisdom. Both of them can be very beneficial, of course. But I think for most of us, the problem that we have, the essential issue, is that we're very scattered and fragmented. I think this is the primary problem that we have, most of the people that I talk to. And so most of our effort, the primary effort, should be on to developing this inner sense of peace, this inner sense of stillness. So when we have, and this gives a completely different attitude towards that tendency of us to move, to be pulled away from stillness. So if we come back to the image of the boulder or the rock in the middle of the stream, and initially I was suggesting we're kind of pushing against it, but maybe we feel like we're a swimmer who's trying to swim against the stream. But actually the rock just sits there, really, doesn't it? The rock doesn't feel that it's kind of straining against the stream. The rock itself is just still, and the rock doesn't really care whether the stream is pulling it one way or the other. It knows where it's sitting. I don't know if you remember, during the late 1970s in Australia, there was quite a well-known sort of series of TV ads, and this competition between Holden and Ford to prove whose cars were the most best handling. And one of them, I can't remember which one was first, came out with this ad that showed their car dodging in between these witches' hats on the ground. And then the other one, their competition came up them, instead of dodging between witches' hats, they were dodging between people. And so they had all these guys standing in a line on the road, and then this car driving very fast, dodging around between them. Of course, up the stakes in the whole thing. And as I met a few years ago, I actually did a seminar together with a fellow who had been a reporter for, I think, the ABC at that time. And he'd interviewed the driver who'd done that, because it was quite a bit of a kind of a, you know, a current topic at the time, quite a striking sight. And he'd interviewed the driver and said, you know, how do you do this? How do you make sure you miss all of those people? And his response was that he doesn't try to miss all the people. He doesn't even think about it. He just aims for the spaces. So if you're thinking about missing the people, then you're kind of you're thinking about the things. And so he wasn't thinking about the things at all. He was thinking about the absences, thinking about the space that he's got to move through, rather than thinking about the obstacles he has to avoid. So that's also a very beautiful way to approach this this perspective on meditation, that it's not about how we deal with the pains we feel in our body. It's not about having to deal with the restlessness that we feel. It's not about having to deal with the sounds that are distracting us, or the thoughts that are distracting us, and the memories and so on. It's about aiming at the spaces. It's about aiming at the silences. It's about being with the emptiness. And so the more we can become one with and feel attuned with that center of silence and peace, the less all of these other things will disturb us. And the focus of our awareness sinks deeper and deeper in consciousness towards more profound and almost more more still forms of silence and emptiness. And as that happens, the flourishes, the fluctuations gradually recede and gradually become less and less important. So instead of being like a very shallow pool of water, and then when the storm comes and the wind comes, the whole pool is very disturbed, and but instead of being like that, we become like a very deep pool of water. And when the storm and the wind lashes the top of the water, then the depths are still quite still, completely undisturbed by what's happening on the surface. Shift in orientation. We're standing on silence, being that still point in the storm. So this is my little talk for you this evening, and I offer this to you for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Bhaktan, can you suggest any ways of bringing that into day-to-day lay life, aside from practice?
No, let's just give up.
Give up what?
Practice? Yeah. It's just too much. You know. It's just too much. Hope has died long ago. Yeah, so it's really just a matter of gritting your teeth and surviving from moment to moment. Not even grinning and bearing it, just bearing it. No, no, yeah, sure. You can use that perception, and it's very useful and quite fun to use that perception. So quite constantly, you know. So, you know, you say for example, this perception of space. You know, go into a room and say, well, what are the things in the room? Your attention is drawn to the things, to the movement, to the activity. But that movement and activity can only happen because there's space around it. Yeah? So as soon as you imagine what's happening, if you took all the space out of the room, then no one can move. Right? You're just jammed up against each other. You can't. Yeah? So in all the noise that's happening, then what about all the silence that's happening around that? So you're going to listen to that as well. I mean, it's very, very much a part of musical practice as well. Was there that famous quote by, I think it was Arthur Rubinstein or someone like that? They asked him, what is it that makes your playing so special? And he said, oh, well, the notes I do just the same as everyone else, but it's the silences. Ah, it's the silences. Yeah. So it's really a trick of perception, you know? And playing with perception. But it's also, that's part of the Darwinian nature of it, is that our consciousness is primed to notice, you know, disturbances and changes and things like that. We want to know when, you know, when the leaves move around us, because there may be something dangerous there. So you're always attuned to disturbance.
In terms of disturbance, as a very experienced meditator, can you remain calm around a lot of disturbance with being able to focus your mind willfully?
Welcome. Not so much focusing your mind willfully. Sometimes you can. But it's more a matter of just gradual training and getting used to certain ways of being and doing things, that's all. Yeah, I mean, in certain cases, yes, you can do that where you deliberately say, okay, you know, I can feel that I'm getting angry with this person, and I'm not going to say words of anger to them. I'm going to deliberately go the other way and be very quiet and gentle with them. So yeah, sometimes it can work like that. But more often, it's just that continual, like, trying to come back to that, just that place of stillness and just trying to relate everything out of there. But one of the problems is, it's a little bit like the problem with Western medicine versus holistic medicine. I mean, with Western medicine, of course, you only go to the doctor after things are too late, when you're already sick, and that's already when you start caring about your health. Whereas from a holistic approach, you start looking after your health right from day one. So that's really the meditative approach. If you rely just on when the trouble arises, then often it's too late to do very much about it. Okay, so I'll finish my main respects to the Triple Jump.